Watch this.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Cookie Jar Golf Podcast, brought to you in partnership with Jack.
Halcyon Golf Travel.
No, with FootJoy. It's not an advert, okay? It's not an advert. But in fact, you, spoiler alert, you, Jack, and, well, you, me, and Lee were all wearing FootJoy today.
We were actually, yeah.
Lee had some nice old icons on, I believe.
He did, yeah. He was a... very waterproof, actually, yeah. And it was a little bit wet today.
Performed superbly, I would say.
Superbly.
Anyway, bit of scene setting for our listeners. We are currently sat in the committee room at Blackwall Golf Club, the epicentre of golf for Cookie Jar. Now, you might not know this, but this is where Mike Clayton sat and did a podcast with us, which never saw the light of day. So we did I think we did about an hour and a half sat in here, and Clayton was sat on my left where I'm sat right now, and Tom was in a bit of a rush to get away. I don't know, he had some sort of commitment. We had a really good podcast. Clates did his usual thing, like so much gold, you know, spilled into the microphone. Turned the microphone off, had a nice time, you know, disappeared, went home, rang me 10 minutes later, issue with the SD card.
Oh, no.
And I think we've only had like one or two of those in the 230 episodes have been going, so...
Have you double-checked the remaining memory on the SD card today?
No, I actually genuinely think this room's cursed. Lee said to us on the 8th tee today, he said, oh, it's bad juju to tee off in front of a birdie and steal the honour. And I think it's bad juju to check the SD card today. So anyway, who are you and where are you from?
My name is Jack Salis. And I'm from Nottingham and a very proud member of Hollinwell.
Mm.
Yeah.
A wonderful club. Great place.
Very, very privileged to have played a lot of golf there throughout my life.
Is that where it started as a kid?
Is where I started, yeah. First club that I joined. There used to be a thing called the Bunnies. A lot of the members' sons and daughters used to go up and just learn how to play. Put a load of bacon sandwiches and Coca-Colas on my dad's account. Yeah. That was part of the course. I played at Hollinwell, also played at Ramsdale Park and Bull Forest, which are, you know...
I know nothing about.
Yeah, well...
Are they both Nottingham as well?
You wouldn't have heard much about them. No, they are both Nottingham, yeah. Hollinwell was a little bit too long for me as a junior. I got into the game very young. Yeah. So I used to play those courses a little bit easier. So Bull Forest was actually the original golf course for the Notts Golf Club.
So, no way.
Yeah. Yeah. So before Willie Park designed Hollinwell, Bull Forest was the OG course.
Okay.
And it's a muni, basically.
Yeah.
But it holds up really well. It's a, you know, sandy soil. It's a good knock.
And that's I'm going to get this wrong now, the north side of Nottingham.
Oh, mate. Don't quote me.
Not far from Hollinwell. Not far from Hollinwell.
20 minutes.
Yeah. Moved out. They were like, we've got a better site.
They moved out, yeah. It was actually, I think, somebody scouting for railroads and like where to lay them. And there was just big expanse of dead land that was good for nothing else apart from a golf course. And yeah, someone got a tip off and said, hey, this might make a really good golf course. It's not good for much else.
Yeah.
And the rest is history.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
I've been there several times the last 10 or 15 years and Hollinwell's exceptional. But it is a big boy golf course, isn't it? It's big.
It's
really big. It's a huge footprint.
Yeah.
It's a big tee to green golf course, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of forced carries off the tee. And, you know, I got into golf when I was like 5 or 6, and you know, for a 6-year-old, was not very suitable. So hence why I played at a few other courses. But you know, it teaches you to hit it straight. That's good. For sure.
Good. Well, there's been a few first fours today, and
I think
we need to start the pod on this.
This deserves some airtime.
I think so. I think we need to introduce all three at once rather than drag it out too much. Can you give us the big first fours today?
Okay.
In bullet fashion.
Okay. So in order of least importance to most important.
Whoa, hang on.
First of all, podcast virgin, first ever podcast.
Okay. Yeah. Congratulations.
So that's first.
You're doing well.
Second, something I've been waiting 20 years for, first hole in one. On the ninth hole at Blackwell. And
congratulations today.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to blow my own trumpet. So, Sam, do you want to talk
no,
us through that one?
No, it was exceptional. I've seen two holes in one in my life now. First was at the sixth at Blackwell. I watched a very, very good high-quality wedge go in. And I actually got told off at the time by Bruce because when this was in the first few months at Cookie Jar Days, I posted a picture of the scorecard. And it was in a medal. And the partner I was playing with, who'll remain anonymous, I posted a picture of the scorecard on there. And Bruce called me out on it. And I think, in fairness, there was a kernel of truth to this. We both shot 33 on the front nine.
Were they not so proud of their scorecard?
Well, no, we were both two under gross on the front nine. But I posted a picture of the front nine, sort of like hole in one alert. And Bruce was like, you're an absolute mule. You've just done that to squeeze in the fact you shot two under around the front nine at Blackwell.
Of course, because you're the marker, aren't you? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
But no, I watched your shot into the ninth. It's playing 165. We're playing sort of whether you call it winter tees up a little bit or whatever. And the sun had just burst through the clouds, hadn't it? And it was, the green was drenched in sunlight. And I thought, God, I should get a little video of this. This is quite a nice image.
I mean, I thought you were videoing.
Well, and then I watched you hitting it. I went, Christ, that looks good. I thought, that's mega accurate. And fell down on the pin, few bounces. And we're like, oh. And it didn't go in the hole.
I turned around.
It didn't go in the hole, did it?
No, I thought I was on the back edge of the green.
Yeah.
It turned around.
And the pin's
then
right back. For anyone who's not played Blackwell, the ninth is it's sometimes a 200, sometimes 160, 170 yard par three. Straight over water. Green's banged front, sort of back to front.
And a bunker behind the green as well.
And the pin's right on the back. So
probably not the play to try and land it past the flag there, but we'll let that slide.
But we watched it and we could still see ball, but you know when you can see it behind the pin.
It was a laser. It was a laser.
It was a great golf shot.
Right over the flag.
And yeah, we walked up and good as gold. There was your pitch mark. 3 feet past the hole. And the ball.
Long overdue is all I can say.
And how old are you now?
I'm 28. And
okay.
I've played
22 years, sans hole in one.
Yeah. It's a long time coming. And I think we've celebrated quite appropriately in the clubhouse at Blackwell today.
I know, I'm absolutely genuinely chuffed. I found that it was like this weird, like nervous energy afterwards. Did you get that? Because we went into the Spike Bar afterwards, had a bottle of champagne and celebrated.
I think that's the best thing you
can
do.
You're like a little on edge, aren't you? You feel a bit.
The worst thing you can do, if that was a tournament, going off a hole in one to then the 10th tee at Blackwell, you've got this huge intimidating bunker and trees. You know, you're a little bit jacked up. You don't.
Yeah.
But having the bottle of champagne and half an hour in between the ninth and 10th really helped. It was quite crucial that. And unfortunately, you're not allowed to do that in major amateur competitions.
It's staggering though, isn't it? Like you've played played the game of golf rather at a very, very high level for quite a long period of time. And that's you must have had a ton of close ones. I think you told me about holding out at the 12th at Deal or something.
Yeah, that was a bit of a car crash situation that in the Caris Trophy, which if you don't know is the English under 18s Open,
okay,
Royal Cinque Ports,
stroke play,
72 holes, one of my favourite links courses in England, Royal Cinque Ports. 12th hole, very demanding par four. I've binned it from 210 yards. 6 iron.
That's the half pipe green, right?
The half pipe green, yeah. Crazy, crazy green. But I didn't actually use the half pipe. It was just right down the flag. Very excited after that. That got me to 4 under. I think I was leading the tournament at the time. Only 12 holes.
60 holes left to play.
Yeah, only 60 holes left. 3 foot at the next green from 10 feet and then putted it into a bunker on the 14th. Yeah. And scraped the cut, I think. And
there's such a thing of getting too excited, isn't
it? I mean, and that is prime example. Yeah. I mean, I was very young and naive and inexperienced at the time. Whoa. Hopefully today has taught me how to handle the nerves a little bit better.
You and Lee played very well. and congratulations. And we'll make sure we come back to the hole in one every 5 or 10 minutes in this
and
pod.
And we've not actually got to the third.
Well, there's two other.
Well, there's two other
first fours, which I think are, I don't know whether they're equal importance, but
equal importance, I'd say. And I think they go hand in hand, actually.
Okay.
So first day at Blackwell, and also the first time having a sherry and brandy or a... Port and brandy.
Port and brandy.
Port and brandy. P&B. I'm getting mixed up with the Chauvrel.
So, I mean, I'll let you put some colour on that because I feel like I'm marking my own homework when I talk about port and brandies and Blackwell Golf Club.
So, well, we've just had a brandy.
Well, yeah, of course, because of the thing, because it turned out that when we went into the lounge at Blackwell, on the side, there's this innocuous sort of decanter that sits there.
Yeah,
and I was ordering some sandwiches and you were like, oh, look, Sam, there's a hole in one decanter. And it's just sort of casually on the side in the lounge at Blackwell, donated by the members of Notts Golf Club. And you duly inquired and filled it up with brandy.
Yeah. I mean, destiny, I'd say.
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, well, we filled it up with brandy. We had a brandy. It was nice.
The members will enjoy it. It's very kind of you.
But this morning at 9:30, we had a brandy topped up with a little bit of port. And
people think it's an extraordinary drink, that, but I actually think, maybe I'm just normalised to it. I think it's a really good morning drink with a coffee before a game of golf.
I think when you suggested it to me before I'd had a coffee today, it did blow my mind slightly. But after trying it, it was thoroughly enjoyed. It's just like a brandy, but a little bit sweeter. Takes the edge off. Very smooth drink. And I think I love it when I go to golf clubs and they've got their own drink.
Little thing.
Yeah, they've got their thing and you don't drink it anywhere else. It's just, you know, when you go to Blackwell, you have the P&B. I think that's great. It's like when you go to, you go to Deal and you have the old sandwich, you have the Chauvrel or you have a couple.
Do you know, Deal sell a chicken Kiev?
Yeah.
Have you heard of this?
I've heard of this, but I've not had one.
Chicken soup with vodka.
Yeah.
Which I think that's a bridge too far.
it's quite loose drink, that. But don't knock it till you've tried it, is all I say.
Well, anyway, let's not make all of this podcast, Jack, about alcohol.
No.
But can you perhaps, for the benefit of the cookie jar and Blackwell Golf Club, put some colour on Blackwell, because you've played in what is a very wet March. It's still a bit wintry, and if I'm honest, I was sort of a bit nervous bringing you guys up here on a fairly wet day with, I think we had 3 temporaries out, which every other golf course is shut, but it's your first time coming here.
Yeah, and I think the most important thing here is context. If you're not based in the Midlands, it's been extremely wet for the last, what seems like forever, actually, since Christmas. Most courses are closed, and Blackwell is a parkland course, and which are notoriously wet. And so I've heard a lot of very good things about Blackwell, but I wasn't expecting much today. I just thought, you know, there's going to be some temporaries and plugged balls and lost balls, but there really wasn't much of that at all. You know, I hit some really good drives that had 20, 30 yards run out, I think. Maybe that's just
saying. And more than 150 yard carry as well. They weren't you know, they weren't sort of across the equator.
Well, I'm not saying it wasn't a topspin lobber, but.
It was good. Yeah, the course held up.
The course has definitely held up. My first time at Blackwell today, some extremely interesting green complexes. I'd love to come back here when it's browned out a little bit in the summer. Mm. Getting the wrong side of the flags here can be really penal. But the course was, you know, considering the weather that we've had, exceptional. And the club has so many quirks. And the spike bar in particular is...
Enjoyed.
Thoroughly enjoyed.
It's good atmosphere, isn't it?
No, and I particularly enjoy the two leaf blowers, which they leave just in the exit to the clubhouse as you... So as you walk onto the 18th green, there's an oak tree at the back of the green, which overhangs over the green. I can imagine in autumn, quite a lot of leaves.
And acorns. So like you have to get them off and you come in.
Yeah. So it's accustomed to blow the green off before before the next group come in. I think that's great.
I think there's something about idiosyncrasies at golf clubs that is just so addictive. It's just.
I think my favorite one was the, you're not, You can't have crisps unless it's with a sandwich in the members' lounge. Golf
club. They don't like bowls of crisps here. It's not a thing. Yeah. And there's like, you can't eat with a fork in the sort of spite bar. And like when those rules were set out, like I think the intent was, it's like, if you're going to eat, if you want a proper meal, go and sit in a restaurant. If you want to have a sandwich. Saying, like
how long has this rule been in place? How many years do you think?
Well, it's probably like, I'm guessing, well, it's a minimum of 40, possibly much more than 60. I don't know. There was a guy at Blackwell.
Some bloke who has likely been dead for at least 30 years decided he didn't like crisps in the members' lounge.
I don't think it was an aversion to crisps. I suspect what it was is like food of substance was like, yeah, great. We want people to get dressed up and sit down and enjoy lunch. And I think it's quite hard to hold on to like a big lunchy culture. Like I think, yeah, club lunch, club culture with lunches. Swallowing own words there. It's quite hard to hold on to because it's like you want to play golf, you want to get away, people have got other commitments. But we're lucky here in the sense of like, you know, it's sandwiches if you're going to eat, and if not, it's like Jack and Ty and go and enjoy a bottle of wine and a proper slap at lunch and stuff. And that's kind of what that rule's about. It's just the idiosyncrasies of how it's worded. It's just like, it's pretty unique.
There's a time and place for it, and Blackwell is definitely the place.
Yeah, it's a good dose of traditionalism.
Yeah, it's great when these traditions can be upheld in 100%. at the right types of clubs, at least.
But back to you. So you touched on it there. You started at the age of six. You played golf at a few clubs. I mean, I guess not dissimilar to me. Maybe as a kid, I remember, you know, I'm not speaking out of turn here when I say the average age of a member at Blackwell when I was a kid was dead. I mean, it was a really old, you know, it was a very old club, and you know, it wasn't a particular place it's not junior friendly. It just wasn't the place you're going to get regular games. And I joined a couple of other local clubs as a junior. So you did some of that. Yeah. But you played a lot of junior golf because you know, without like blowing too much smoke here, like you're a very good player. Like you've played at some really good level stuff. So you played Lytham last year, for example. And I think it's a good opportunity to talk about maybe a bit about your journey in golf and a bit of a platform into amateur golf. Because somewhere along the line, you've made a decision to say, do you know what? I'm not going to chase it as a pro. I've actually just thought, do you know what? I'm going to get more out of the game, I'm guessing. I don't know. What point was that decision made where you thought, I'm not going to be a pro, you know?
So I think I subconsciously made that decision when I was 16 or 17. Before then, I put a lot into golf. There was a lot of sacrifice. Anybody trying to make it in sport, it's just a part of the game. And I did that. And I was extremely lucky to get a scholarship to go to Wellington College, which is, you know,
golf scholarship, right?
Golf scholarship to go there. It was golf and academic scholarship. And, you know, they have an excellent golf program at Wellington. And the idea when I joined was to, you know, for that to be a, you know, like a catapult for my golf and put more into it. But actually it had the complete opposite effect from going to that school, just from seeing that my friends, like what their parents were doing, and, you know, very affluent, you know, to say the least. It just opened my eyes to what was out there. And I think I'd had tunnel vision before, thinking, right, okay, I'm doing golf. And then going there opened my eyes to the world. And
absolutely.
And I didn't know then that I wanted to. I think I'd given so much to golf and not quite had the results that I wanted. I mean, I had a pretty good junior career, but I never did anything spectacular. I wasn't a superstar.
You weren't winning British Boys?
Who would have been
your contemporary? Because I'm guessing you'd have played things like British Boys as a kid.
Yeah, so I played British Boys with Matt Fitzpatrick, for example.
Like did he seem light years ahead at that point?
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't really on my radar at the time. I mean, I think because I just wasn't even in his category of, you know, golfer. I was to most people, what would have seemed, you know, very, very good junior golfer, but if you look at it a little bit more in depth, I wasn't at the very, very top level. But at that age, it's kind of irrelevant anyway. You know, it's hard to tell who's going to make it at 16. But by going to Wellington, it opened my eyes to other career options. And because I'd given so much to golf and not got all of it out of it that I wanted, it was easier for me to shelf it for a few years. And that's what I did.
Did you?
Yeah.
So you just, what, cold turkey? Or
no,
just...
not cold turkey. So from Wellington, I went to Durham and didn't really enjoy golf that much in first year.
Which is quite a big sporting uni, isn't it?
It's a very big sporting uni, and golf was probably one of the biggest reasons why I got into the uni.
Right.
They wanted me to play for the golf team, which I did in
clean
the first year.
Clean sweep of D's. Short game to die for.
Something like that. But didn't really get on that well in first year there. I wasn't enjoying my golf much. And then second year of uni is where it all changed for me. I, you know, met some different lads who weren't taking golf so seriously. And, you know, we'd play golf, but it wasn't the be all and end all, because, you know, whether you play good or bad, we have a beer after, we have some fun. Mm. And that was the first time really I'd got... Golf had been that for me. Before then, golf was just all about winning.
Sport.
Yeah, it was just sport, winning, and that's all that mattered. It wasn't the camaraderie. It wasn't the social aspect. It was just about winning. And then, you know, at the age of sort of 19, 20, that all changed. And then golf just became just a haven for me. It was just the best thing ever. I'm doing something that I'm good at, and I enjoy every time I play, and I'm making friends. And since then, I've never looked back, and I've forged a career out of that attitude that I had towards golf. It's not just about winning; it's the camaraderie and the making friends. And super, super grateful for, you know, it's almost weird. All the events that have happened in my life have happened in, you know, just the right order and sequence to get to where I am now. Mm. And I'm so happy with golf at the minute.
You're in a really good place.
I'm in a very good place, yeah.
You're in a very good place. You've had a bottle of champagne, you're halfway through a Guinness. You've had your first hole in one and a great day of Blackwell. You're in a good space with golf. I like it. But it's really interesting, isn't it? Because it's a really difficult just general period of life, that between like 18 and 24, there's a lot going on and...
A lot of really important decisions to be made as well.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. And it's like, you know, you've got something that you're very, very committed to for a very long period of time. And I think it's very hard for juniors who are used to winning everything at their club and just being like the prodigy at their local club. But there are thousands of golf clubs in the UK.
Yeah.
And then thinking, maybe I'm not going to make it at that level. And another close friend of mine, same, you know, just sort of got to a point where it was like, yeah, I'm just not gonna make it on tour. And then it almost has to flip then how you interact with the game of golf, I guess, really, and what you try and take from it. Because teeing it up to shoot 65 is very different to teeing it up to have a really good day and a good day's match play.
Yeah, totally. And I guess it's hard for kids that have aspirations to be professional golfers. And if you want to win and make it, you have to have a really, really positive mindset. You need to think that you're going to make it and win.
Mm.
But if you look at it more broadly, if you're having that mindset, can actually hold you back from making, you know, the best decisions in your life, rational decisions.
Yeah.
You know, because at the end of the day, you're probably not good enough to make it on the PGA Tour. You know, for every 1,000 kids that think they've got it, one has.
Yeah.
So there's a balance between being optimistic and realistic.
Mm.
Yeah.
And you're now, wind the clock on, what, sort of 9 years or so?
Yeah.
Since then, you're now running a golf travel company, and you're in a completely different space in the golf industry. You know, you're organizing tours for people, you're traveling, but you're also playing really high level amateur events. We should say we're recording this podcast on the 15th of March, and tomorrow they're going to play the Lord Warden at Rye, which just means it's your last day as the current defending Lord Warden champion.
It's my last day. as the Lord Warden.
Is that the main thing?
Does that make me the Lord Warden? I don't know.
We touched on this. So the Lord Warden at Rye is, that's a Rye and Deal plus, plus some invited sort of, I say high-level amateur golfers. I was trying to play in that. And if high-level amateurs is the qualification criteria, then we're all screwed.
I think Rye, Sandwich and Deal members and a couple other and friends, I think.
And you won that last year?
Yeah, won that first time.
Yeah.
Had a very good day on the greens. My friend Stu Mackey invited me and a great day out. And happened to clinch it by one.
Really?
Yeah.
It was that close then?
Clinch it by one. And I think I did 150 foot of putts on the back nine. It was quite filthy.
So is it really tough, that event?
It is quite tough, yeah.
Because I always feel like Rye is quite a playable golf course in terms of, like, you can get it away off the tee, usually in quite a few directions.
I mean, I think Rye is nails.
Do you?
Yeah, I'm a left to right hitter of the ball, and quite a lot of the holes there require a right to left shot.
Okay.
But it is very difficult. The first hole is easy, par five, classic old school golf course.
And that's the only par five you get.
Yeah, before the days of practice grounds, they used to make the first hole like a nice opener. Yeah. So if you don't birdie the first, basically you're screwed.
But it's really a tough four, isn't it? I suppose
it's a tough four more than a five. But after then, it's just relentless.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very tough. And, you know, 17, 18, I don't think there's a tougher, you know, closing stretch in golf. 240-yard par three with a funky green.
It's very tough green to hit.
Very funky green, followed by 18th hole. Anything more than 2 yards right at the fairway is just in some ginormous chasm. Where it's potluck, whether or not you find your ball, and left of the fairway is in the dunes or down on the 10th tee.
Has that been the highlight of the amateur career? I don't want you to say no. Sorry,
no.
I should rephrase that, because I led you into that. But do you know what I mean? I think you won anything else as an amateur, I'll be more.
Well, I won the junior events. Won the Midland Boys, which was at the time was really big for me.
As did Sandy Lyle, who's an honorary member here. He won the Midland Boys here.
Yeah. I actually think the heart of my amateur career was in a team format in the Halvard Hewitt.
Right.
Yeah. And it was as an 18-year-old in my first ever Hewitt, first round, playing the match five, 2-2, going down extra holes.
So it's all down on this?
It's all on this match.
So you've played one and two already at Deal in the playoff?
Yeah, so we'd played the first, the second, halved in fours, and by this point, it was definitely the biggest crowd I've ever played in front of.
Really? Is that a lot of, because everyone's come out at this point?
Yeah, you know, there might be 70 or 80 people there, and you know, all stood around the third green at Deal, which is a bit of an amphitheatre anyway.
Natural sort of bowl.
Bit of a punch bowl, and I'm stood there for way too long deliberating what shot to play, and I end up just taking out the 60 degree full swing it, and I can see the old boy shaking their heads behind the green like, what is he doing? And I've just flopped this ball up and landed it a foot next to the pin, shake hands. And there's just something about hitting a really good shot when it doesn't just matter to you, it matters to the whole team, and everyone's like, yes, we get to stay another day and play another game at Deal, and we're not going home or playing in the plate. So that, I think that was the highlight of my amateur career, actually, that hole, that shot. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a really, really good feeling, because it's not very often you get to play as a team in golf.
No.
It's an individual sport and it can be quite lonely. So yeah, in the team format, hitting a good shot at a good time is a really good feeling.
That's interesting. That's really interesting. And you'll be playing in that, I'm guessing, in a couple of weeks' time?
Yep. So it coincides with the Masters.
The centenary or the 100th playing? I'm still not sure which. I'm pretty sure it's the centenary of the first playing of the Halvard Hewitt.
I think so, yes. I think so. There's going to be some...
Do you know that was cooked up at the Addington over lunch? That
was
idea?
It?
Yeah.
Oh, didn't know
And
that.
I think the final of the first ever Halvard Hewitt was played at the Addington.
Really? Yeah. Oh, so it wasn't always at Deal, was it?
First year it was played, I think they sent them out all over the place around London playing matches. And then the final was played at Addington.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was the very first ever Halford Hewitt, which is now obviously a legendary public school tournament played, but you know, between a lot of schools in the country.
Yeah.
All old boys at those schools. Standards quite good as well. Like
in recent years, it's very got good. Very good.
It like used your to schools be like Loretto are like exceptional players.
Ex pros plus three amateurs. It used to be a bit of a jolly boys, I think.
But teams of 10.
Yeah, teams of 10, foursomes.
But you've got people who've played foursomes. 60 or 70 Hewitts, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the days of that are gone. I think a lot of the schools that play now have got really strong golf programs set in place, and they're churning out scratch golfers every year. And gone are the days of the, you know, 70-year-olds playing in that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's actually turning into quite a high-level amateur tournament.
But there is an attraction to amateur golf in the country, isn't there? Where I do think, you know, one of the first few podcasts we did was with Lucas Michel, who'd won the US Mid Amateur. And he was like, look, the great thing about amateur golf is we just get to play at really good places.
You play far better golf courses on the amateur circuit than you do on the professional circuit.
And you play fairly actively on that? Like is that more of like a competitive drive for you to stay keen, or is that more a case of like actually it just facilitates quite a nice life of traveling? Like what you know, which is it? Because
it's a little bit of both, to be honest. I mean, it having a card in your hand playing at the highest level that you possibly can. You know, I'm not going to play in the US Amateur, but I can play in the Lytham Trophy,
which is still ridiculously high standard.
Exceptionally high standard.
That's the highest ranked amateur event outside the British Am in the UK, I think.
I think so, yeah. So I played in that last year, and nothing beats the buzz of playing with a card in your hand and having every shot really, really matters. I really do get a buzz from that. And, you know, luckily I had a friend I could go up and play it with, which made it more fun for me. Mm. I think if I wasn't working in the industry that I am and yet working for myself and in the world of golf, I probably wouldn't play them just because I'm just not quite competitive enough at that level right now. And it's a bit of a financial commitment, and also it's a time commitment. It's a full week off work, basically.
Mm.
And to compete against these a lot of young guys that are giving it a real run at trying to make it pro.
Because the Lytham is a straight amateur event, right? Which basically means anyone with an amateur status, irrespective of age.
Exactly.
Whereas you're 28 and, you know, you're playing against guys who are, you know, playing in D1 teams in America, people who will be PGA Tour pros in time.
Yeah, you're playing against
Frank Kennedy, didn't you?
Yeah, I played with Frank Kennedy in round one and two, who has since turned pro.
Pre-Walker Cup as well.
I think he got the Walker Cup pick and then turned pro anyway, which is quite a bold move.
But although I remember he posted on his Instagram about it. It wasn't a great look. It was like, I'm done with amateur golf. I've achieved everything I can achieve. He won it that year.
He did win the Lytham Trophy.
Did he have Fanny on the bag?
He had Fanny Sunnerton on the bag.
Extraordinary.
I had my dad on the bag. And he's
playing out of Jupiter
and he's looking
Hills.
Down the range going, that's Fanny Sunnerton. I says, no, surely not, Dad. Just leave it. Like, don't.
That was your dad?
Yeah. I was like, don't go celebrity hunting now. We rock up to the first tee. And yeah, it was Fanny Sunnerton. And she's caddying for the chap that I'm playing with. And she was a breath of fresh air.
Was she?
Such a nice woman. Such a nice woman. And she was so professional. And I think without her, Frank might not have done it.
Do you think that makes all the difference?
Yeah.
That level?
I mean, Frank was he's a very serious guy and a very serious golfer as well. I mean,
good.
Goes without saying, yeah, very good. But in the second round, he missed a ton of fairways. He might have hit four fairways all the way around, had seven birdies. And they tricked that course up because the weather was quite benign, and I guess they don't want people to shoot too low. They put the pins in very difficult places. They tipped it out, and on some of the holes, I can see him and Fanny, and you know, they're trying to figure out lines because they're just so far off the planet, off the tee. It was like Tiger at the Masters, just hitting it into shit, and somehow just getting the ball, manufacturing a shot, get the ball on the green, hole a 20-foot putt onto the next. He's coming out with birdies when I thought he'd be making bogey double. And I think that's the sign of a real, that's what champions do.
You thought it was quite impressive. Yeah,
it was really impressive. Really impressive.
Because he's turned pro quite young.
Very young. I think when I played with him, he was only 17. I just thought his tenacity for a 17-year-old was quite phenomenal. But you know, he's got a long way to go if he's going to make it. And you know, there's a lot of, you know, big things that are going to happen in his life in the next 3-4 years, and how he deals with those things will essentially determine how well he does, I think.
It's really tricky, isn't it? Because you think, you know, when I was 17, I still am immature, but like, you really are, you know, you're completely different head on your shoulders.
Yeah, I mean.
And you did, was he like super composed? Like really like, God, this guy just looks in control, or was it?
Not really.
It was really Fanny that was sort of keeping the wheels on, like, you know.
Fanny was keeping the wheels. He was very passionate, is how I'd put it. But you look at professional golfers on the PGA Tour and they're also passionate. It's not as if they've got a completely level head after they hit a bad shot.
They're very controlled around
the ball. You know, it's controlled anger, and then, you know, you can have a head off for 30 seconds and then get it out of your system, carry on. And it doesn't really matter how you react directly after you hit a shot. It's what's your head state before you hit your next shot. That's all that really matters. But you know, that's the caliber of golfer that you're playing with now in these amateur tournaments. And you know, Frank's playing full time. I'd say 90% of the players in these top amateur tournaments are either playing collegiate golf in the US or playing full time amateur circuit. And the average age of people nowadays is probably 10 years younger than the top amateur events 20, 30 years ago. It's the age has really dropped.
I popped up last year because I was in Lytham anyway. Wife's from Lytham. And I think Matt McLean was playing and Richard Knightley, two guys. And Matt McLean's past guest of the podcast. I know Richard Knightley from just through some friends in Dublin. And, you know, talking to them, and it was very clear that it was a very serious amateur event for them.
Yeah.
And yeah, I sort of like quite quickly exposed to it. But when I popped up, the scoring was like not that impressive. There was lots in the 80s. And I remember thinking, God, is this just like a...
It's a really like, hard golf course.
Because I remember thinking, yeah, like I could... It's like standard Sam Williams comment this. I could chop it around here in 83. But they buried the pins. And I remember you saying it was tough to get down in 4 feet into the greens.
And yeah, when you're teeing off at 7:30 in the morning and there's a bit of dew on the ground... Mm. And it's half a club into wind, and you're still on the first tee. It's a 210-yard par three.
No doubt.
I'm pulling out all the stick I can without pulling a head cover. And it's quite intimidating for a first tee shot. And then after then, on the front nine, there's five holes where anything right of the fairway is out of bounds, and anything left of the fairway is in a pot bunker.
Are you in a difficult age with amateur golf right now? Because you're neither really wanting to compete with hyper competitive D1 collegiate kids, neither are playing in a zone of like concentrated pint men, sort of like plus four golfers.
It is a difficult age, I'd say. There's a hunger to be competitive and play in events that matter and have prestige. But also, you know, if I'm going to take a few days off work, I want to be able to have a beer with the guys that I'm playing golf with after we've played and socialize, which I don't really think you get in modern amateur golf. Modern amateur golf is just professional golf with no paychecks. Mm. That's what it is. And I think mid-am in Europe and America is where people like me slot into really nicely. It's got, it's for top level amateurs who have a family or a full-time job who can't practice every day. They, you know, they're once or twice a week players, but still competitive. And if they're taking a few days off work, they want to have some fun off the course. You know, it, if you shoot 80, it doesn't matter. You're still going to have a, you know, some good crack with your playing partners. And it really is quite disappointing that that just doesn't exist in the UK.
It does in America, and it's quite vibrant. But yeah, the mid-amateur qualification in America for our American listeners would be...
It's 25 years old. Whereas in the
UK... Because at that point, those collegiate players have made the decision to move on with their golf.
You've made the decision way before the age of 25, whether or not...
Whereas the UK, we operate at 35.
Yeah, so the mid-am in the UK is 35, which I think needs adjusting to 25. I think...
Turkeys don't vote for Christmas, though, do they?
Well, yeah, that's true. But I think...
I'm 37 and I'm not playing in either. I'm quite happy with you out of the field on the basis of today.
Well, fair comment. But I think 30 years ago, if you looked at the average age of golfers in the British amateur, it would be, you know, 25 to 30. Because there weren't that many people at 18 giving it a full shot at amateur golf and playing full time. Whereas now, if you take the average age of the British amateur and the English amateur and the Lytham Trophy...
How many doctors or lawyers or...
Zero.
You know...
Zero. It's the average age is 19 years old. And so your 25-year-olds who have already decided that they're not going to be pros and they've taken a career in something else... They're kind of, you're stuck in no man's land for about 15 years. I mean, it's first world problems.
Course. Like no one's got the violin out for you here.
No.
But it's quite interesting. It's like there's definitely scope for something. Like you were saying, there is some form of a mid amateur circuit to play on.
Yeah, there's a very good mid amateur.
The RNA ceased sanctioning like a mid amateur.
I don't understand what's happened there. I don't know why they've taken that away. And there's some new over 35s mid-am tour that's, you know, looks quite good. I've not played in any, obviously. I'm a few years off that. But they play at some pretty good venues and looks quite competitive and, you know, great. But what about the over 25s?
You can maybe start doing some sort of Morris Flitcroft thing where you sort
of... I'm petitioning now. Anyone who's listening...
Make yourself look older and just sort of turn up under an alias. Can just go and rinse it. How did you
I think I'm halfway there, to be honest.
What would be your favourite amateur events in the UK to play in?
My favourite amateur events? Well, I think we've touched on one. The Halford Hewitt is just magic.
But and if you for, didn't but, happen to go to
but that's a
one
little
school.
Bit. It's a closed shop, the Halford Hewitt Fair. The Sunningdale foursomes is amateur and professional. Yeah.
Tell us about that because you played in that last week with a friend of the podcast, Jake Austin.
Yeah.
Massive shout out to Jake.
Yeah. Big shout out, Jacob Austin. Great friend of mine. What a lad. Carried me a little bit last week.
Deathly from inside 100 yards. Like ridiculously competent golfer.
He, in the first round, has putted like an absolute god.
Which was just so standard for him.
Yeah, which you wouldn't expect anything less from Jacob.
No.
He's a wizard. I mean, so a bit of context, playing in the Sunningdale foursomes with Sunningdale member Jacob. He's a fairly new member, but he's very, very quickly attained legendary status at Sunningdale.
He's won like the last four or five club championships, which is...
His name is...
It's not a day, we should say. It's a series of events throughout the year there.
I'm not 100% sure how it works. I think it's played over a few medals and a match play thing. But he's on the board a lot in the clubhouse at Sunningdale. And also one of the nicest guys to work in the golf industry.
Amazing.
Yeah, legend. But yeah, the Sunningdale foursomes is just... It's just class. Sunningdale itself, you know, just away from the tournament, it's one of these golf courses where, well, clubs as well, they just do everything right, and it's not snooty or pretentious. I mean, it's a very, very affluent club. But you go there and you don't feel out of place. You know, it's very rare. You can walk into a clubhouse and, you know, they don't really mind what you wear. And there's you know, masters of industry in there and celebrities, but it's a very, very relaxed atmosphere. Mm. The staff make you feel so welcome, and especially during the foursomes week where there's a lot of guests and visitors playing, you almost feel like you belong the whole time there. They make you feel so welcome.
And the quality of the golf.
Off the charts. Because,
like, without joking, like, that, you know, you're a highly competent player and so is Jake Austin. And there's lots of very high caliber golfers playing there. They're going out early rounds. You're like Rob Rock. You're like, well, he's got to do well. And this guy's like a seriously good player. These guys are going out early doors to names that you've not necessarily seen before because they're like crazy good.
And that's what makes it such a good tournament, I think.
What, the surprise factor?
There's a bit of a surprise. And I think foursomes is a little bit of a leveler because you both have to play well. You can't just hide behind one person playing good. If the other person's not on their day, it's hard to compensate in foursomes. But anyone can win the Sunningdale foursomes. There's a lot of really good pairs that get knocked out early doors. And like I said, the foursomes is a bit of a leveler. Anyone and everybody in the field is exceptional. It's just top level. And, you know, it's amateurs, professionals, men and women all playing off the same tees. It's just a great event. It's one of the highlights of the amateur calendar for sure.
And it was always known as the curtain raiser for the golfing season, which is amazing.
Yeah.
You're now working in the golf industry.
Yeah.
You are now the, how do you term yourself? Managing director, chief executive, director of golf for Halcyon Golf Travel, which as a tour operator basically places like guys from overseas with really good golf tours over in the UK, whether it's England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, at some of the best places and crafts kind of, I guess, unique, you know.
Yeah, golf and experience fixer is long and short of it.
How did you fall into that?
Quite bizarre, really. At university, this is post discovering second team golf, a little bit more social and less serious.
Wheels have come off now.
The wheels have firmly, but truly come off.
He's chipping with a 6-iron and thinking about what he needs to do in 2 years at this point. He's a man after our own hearts.
So, okay, well, I'm not going to be on tour anytime soon. Mm. So how do I make some cash? And, you know, I'd done a couple of internships before going to university and I'd experienced life in the city and didn't rate it, hated it actually. And I've never really been one for doing anything that I don't really like.
Yeah.
And
there's a lot to be said for that.
Yeah. And the things I do really like are playing golf and hosting people on, you know, coming to my course, organizing trips away for my friends and doing stuff. So I just thought, well, let's do that. Very, very simple train of thought. Just do what I like and what I'm already good at and charge people for it. And did a little bit of research and, you know, saw a few other companies doing something similar to what I do. And thought, oh, yeah, they seem to be doing all right. I think I can do it better.
Mm.
And, you know, since then, you know, it's been a work in progress the whole time. You're constantly evolving and improving and making the experiences better and more authentic for people. And, yeah, I mean, it's just a never-ending road, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's no shock on this pod, but... Yeah, traveling with the game of golf is like the best.
It's
like, for me, it's like everything. It's the, like you say, the clubhouse smell. It's the, you know, what they serve. It's the where's the first tee. But it is a really, you know, going over to America recently, it's like amazing how quick you're on the back foot when you're outside of your comfort zone.
Yeah.
It's easy. Like in the UK, like I roughly know where I'm heading to golf clubs. I know roughly what the customs are of what's expected of me or whatever, and probably where to go to stay or to drink or to eat. But it's quite difficult for somebody who's never been to the UK before or has never been to Ireland before, or it's like their first experience down in London, to know quite how this thing all maps out.
Yeah. And it's Exactly. And it's, I think it's even, I mean, for us going to America is, can be a little bit of a shell shock. You don't quite know what to expect, but I think it's an even bigger shell shock coming from America to the UK, where I don't think, you know, the service that you receive at British golf clubs is quite up to standard as in the, is in the US, and it's all a little bit more of a mystery.
Service culture is like non-existent. It's not, left to chance often.
Yeah, not non-existent, and all the rules are way stricter. And there's,
in some ways,
yeah, in some ways, yeah, and there's, the clubs are all just so different, and just having somebody to guide you through that, and a lot of the, if you want to play the real top venues, a lot of it is just, you know, just some basic advice to avoid embarrassment or just to maximize your enjoyment at these places goes a really long way.
What are the sort of golden rules of golf travel, do you think? So if, like, you know, if you're in the position of,
yeah,
I'm going to the UK for the first time, whether it's with my kids, whether it's with some buddies, yeah, what are like the golden rules that you just wouldn't sacrifice?
Okay. I mean, probably a slightly easier way of approaching this is, what are the biggest mistakes that people make when they come over? And the number one biggest mistake is people try to cram too much golf in. Golf, playing golf courses over here, it's not just about playing the course, it's about experiencing the club. And I don't really recommend playing a round of golf and then shooting off to try and play 18 holes somewhere else. And a lot of people want to do that. They just want to cram as much golf in as they can. And I say, no, take your time. You know, go there, have breakfast, play golf, hang around in the clubhouse, talk to the members, you know, look at the... I mean, a lot of the clubhouses in the UK are, especially England, actually, are like museums.
Yeah.
The you know, the memorabilia that's knocking around the clubhouse is just, you know, it's unreal.
So you'd be like, take time.
Yeah, take your time. Don't rush. Don't try and cram too much golf in. That'd be my first tip. Second tip is stick to regional clusters. I get a lot of people that, you know, send us inquiries through the website are obviously reading top 100 lists and articles, and they get a list of five or six golf courses and think, oh, wow, these are all amazing. And they want to play all of them in a week. but they don't realize it. If you look at a map of the UK, yeah, it looks quite small, but trying to play, you know, Royal St. George's and then Royal Dornoch the following day isn't going to work. That's a 12-hour drive.
But people will try, won't they? You must get those.
People
requests.
Try and do it, and well, I advise against it. But the customer's always right, I guess.
But will you do that? Like, will you? It's hard to talk people down, because if it feels like,
I mean, I would not let anybody play Sandwich and then Royal Dornoch the following day unless they were going to fly.
Yeah.
You know, if they, you know, some people private jet it. It's probably too far for a helicopter. You can do Heathrow to Inverness. That's not so bad. I think there's so many great regional clusters in the UK and Ireland that you can just stick to. What I tend to say to people is, if you're coming for, say, 7 nights, pick two places that you want to go to and play three courses in each place. So at least then you get a little bit of variety. You get to visit two different places, stay in two different hotels. You can play the top three golf courses in each region rather than sticking to one and playing three great courses and three fillers. 7 out of 10s.
Yeah.
So that would be my second tip. You know, pick two pick two regions and play the best three courses in each region.
Because it's very easy to hop around. You just don't want to be hopping around on a daily basis.
Yeah, and you know what? If budget is not an issue for you and you want to get a helicopter and fly around, then great, do that. But for 90% of people, that just isn't an option.
Yeah.
My third tip is, don't pack so much luggage. This is probably one of the biggest questions I get. Is, what should I bring? And I just say, well, whatever you thought you were going to bring, just bring half, because you're going to do your brains in at the pro shop. And you can wear that when you come around, when you play everywhere. So, and, you know, people try and plan, you know, mean, I'm still very guilty of this. You know, I'm away all the time and I always overpack.
But yeah, you always pack enough underwear to budget, you know.
No, not always.
You do. You always pack enough underwear to ensure you get caught short five times a day. Like you do. You're like, I probably don't need 20 pairs of underwear.
I think I fall more into the region of 10 polo shirts and 3 pairs of underwear.
Yeah, you just don't, but you totally overpack. It's like a thing.
Yeah, and you know, 9 times out of 10, you don't even change after you've played golf. You end up, you stay in the clubhouse, have a few beers, yeah. And then by the time you're back in St. Andrews, it's, oh, well, let's just carry on. Let's go for dinner.
I think there's a real thing of like being comfortable staying put for a bit. It's really hard. And like, we're the most guilty. Like, we're going to Wales in a couple of weeks. By the time this comes out, we might have already been to Wales. Who knows? But we are biting off way more than we can chew. We're trying to play an absurd number of golf courses. So it's like pot, kettle and black syndrome here. But it's like sometimes the best thing to do is to just really, really enjoy the 18.
Yeah.
And stay put and enjoy it and soak it up.
Yeah, yeah. I think you don't unless you're playing 36 of the same course... If it, for example, going to Muirfield, it's accustomed to play
today.
Yeah, you know, it's a full day. It's a lunch. It's singles. It's foursomes. Great day.
That's a great day.
That's a great day.
Is that a headline for? That's like the big thing. So if you go to East Lothian, it's like I want to play Muirfield. You're like, great.
Yeah,
you're going to East Lothian, and we're going to build it around that.
Yeah, and Royal St George's is similar, and arguably, if you went to Sunningdale, you can play the old course and the new course. That's all great, but apart from these, you know, very select venues, just do 18. You don't need to squeeze 36 in. Make the most of the club and the day and the whole experience.
How hard is it to get people to go and play some of the lesser names? Because it must be hard when, you know, again, it's like us going over to the US. Like, oh, I'm going to New York. I really want to play National. I want to play Shinnecock. And it's like, okay, yeah, I get it. But there's a lot of other really good golf courses. Is it hard to push people into... I don't know. I think it's unfairly badged the sort of the add-on, the likes of Kilspindie or whatever. But like, is it hard to get people to those places? Or is it, because I feel like very often some of those are the most rewarding when you go and travel.
Absolutely. It is quite challenging sometimes. And I get it. If you're traveling 5,000 miles and you know, it's a once in a lifetime holiday for you, you want to play some bucket list courses, but there are some amazing golf courses in the UK that most visitors have never heard of. Mm. And I know they're as good as, you know, the Old Course or Carnoustie or, you know, these big names that you've heard, that everybody's heard of. There are equivalents, you know, scattered around the UK that are a fraction of the price.
You can't pay people to play Ely half the time.
Yeah.
They go to St Andrews and it's like, they look at you like you've got two heads when you say you should play Ely. It's like, it's unbelievably good golf course.
And there's countless examples, you know, across Scotland, Ireland and England, these places. And they are literally a fraction of the price. They're just not necessarily in the epicenter of these golfing hotbeds.
Yeah.
And the courses aren't, the management of the courses aren't necessarily switched on to the US market, which is a lot of the time what drives the prices up. And I think when you look at golf in the UK, you shouldn't... The correlation between green fee price and the quality of the course, that is not a linear correlation.
You don't think?
No. There's a...
Almost law of diminishing returns.
Mm, yeah, almost. You know, you can play a course for, you know, 100 quid and derive just as much enjoyment out of a course that you play 300 quid for.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I mean, I don't know if you want to get into examples of that, but there's...
Well, I'm curious, like, where's like, so you're on the receiving end of a load of requests. Like, where is, like, let's just take the Old Course as like, and take that off the table as like an exception. But like, where do you get the most, where's the highest demand for golf right now as a traveling golfer?
Well, St Andrews, just the area of
taking them off the table.
The whole region of St Andrews and Fife.
Well, I'm
out.
Guessing, like, because ultimately a lot of it's predicated on the Old Course, right? So, like,
well, yeah,
you're going to get a lot of queries that centre around wanting to play the Old.
Let's take that out of it then. So, at the minute, would probably be Southwest Ireland. It's getting a lot of attention for me. Also,
Hinge, Ballybunion, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, all those places. And, you know, that, I mean, it really is a hotbed over there for good golf. But you've got courses like Dukes. Dukes would be my number one, you know, under 200 euro green fee around
really?
There. Yeah.
Crazy logo.
Yeah. The
frog.
The Natterjack toad.
Is that what it is?
It's a Natterjack toad, yeah. So apparently endangered species, but they seem to thrive around there. They're protected and that's the logo. Yeah.
The worst thing you can find if you want to build a links course is a Natterjack toad.
Well, actually, I might be getting confused. It's either there or I think at Hoylake, they're protecting the Natterjack toad.
They are.
On the 11th or the 12th on the left side. Yeah. I might have been mixed up with that, but definitely some kind of toad.
So you see Southwest Ireland, that's kind of like...
We're getting a lot of bookings for there at the minute.
And what's the least tapped into? Because I think there's like a big tourist run in like the key hotbeds, whether it's Dublin,
England.
Southwest Ireland, Northern Ireland, you've got Fife, East Lothian, Ayrshire. Where's like the most untapped?
Yeah, so I mean, slightly biased being an Englishman, and I'd love to see, you know, more tour groups come through England. It's a tough sell. I mean, most guys, I mean, the customers who I service are all from USA and Australia, and Ireland is usually the first place they want to go to.
Mm-hmm.
Scotland the second, and specifically the old course in St Andrews, and England is an afterthought, and I'd say 3/4 of people don't even bother going, and then 25% will go on their fourth, fifth, sixth trip.
Really?
Yeah. And so it is a little bit of an afterthought, which is a shame, because I genuinely think there's a tour in England which is the best golf tour that you can do in the whole of the UK, and that's Surrey, Berkshire, London area.
Heathlands.
Yeah, so you've got, you know, you play 3 or 4 world-class Heathland golf
courses.
There is
about 15 you could pick from. Like, they don't start end at Sunningdale in the Berkshire. Like,
any 4 of those 10 would all work.
Yeah.
And then a few days of links golf, which is, at the end of the day, what everyone comes to the UK for. They want to play proper links. And you get that down at Royal St. Paul's, Royal St. George's and Prince's.
And they're all great.
Yeah, they're all great. All open court. You get 3 open championship courses there.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if you pick your courses wisely around London, if you play Sunningdale, Old, New, and then say St George's Hill and Swinley Forest.
But you can even sub in like a Hankley Connacht or a Woking.
I mean, you've played all World Top 100
Zealand
courses there.
Like, these are like...
Like you've just played 6.
Well, yeah, that's 6 you've named.
Yeah,
there.
You've just played 6 World Top 100 courses. It's off the charts, the quality of golf that you're playing. And but then you slip in a Hankley Common, which, by the way, I think is in the top 3 courses in Surrey. Well, that's under £200 green fee. It's like less than half the price of a King's Barnes.
But it's staggeringly good.
Staggering. They got a new head greenkeeper, I think about 4 years ago, and it's just changed their path. Everything is just so tight, everything there. And it's an expansive piece of land. I think they filmed part of James Bond there, actually.
Correct.
Yeah. But, you know, you can't see a single building apart from the clubhouse. It's just heather and pine trees for as far as you can see. Gentle undulation. You know, just not a blade of grass out of place. Really, really special club, that Hankley Common. That's in my, you know, top 5 hidden gems in the whole of the UK, I'd say.
Is Kintyre a little bit sort of off the map a little bit, because it's, in some ways, it's kind of lucky because it's kind of an awkward place to get to.
Yeah. So Kintyre, for those that don't know, is on the west coast of Scotland. It's kind of like an island, but you've got a, you know, from Glasgow, it's probably only 30 miles away, but to drive there...
More of an archipelago, would you say?
Sorry?
More of an archipelago, would that be the right word?
That's beyond me.
I think it's an archipelago.
Yeah, well...
It's a spit of land.
Yeah, it's a spit of land. You've got to drive north to come back down south. You've got to drive 200 miles or fly 20 miles.
I think archipelago is a collection of islands, actually.
Yeah, I really don't know what you're talking about.
I'm going to have to Google this now.
Google that.
Google Archipelago. Because I think I
don't know if you were talking about film.
I think an archipelago. I've absolutely. What is good? Is an area that contains a chain or a group of islands. It's not an archipelago. That would be the Hebrides, really.
Sorry, Tom, you're going to have to edit this.
Tom's
going
to have to take that out.
You have to edit this. Right there. Yeah,
but, but it is a peninsula, perhaps.
Yeah, peninsula. Mull of Kintyre.
Yeah, and then Paul McCartney's got his house Paul that McCartney. Overlooks Macanish. Yeah. He gets to the sort of stretch at the far end.
Also,
the
song for Nottingham Forest.
That's where he wrote the Mull of Kintyre.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a classic example of, you know, a pretty, you know, untrod part of Scotland for your average US tourist.
And a truly staggeringly good golf course, Macanish. But you've got a lot more there, haven't you? Like, it's not just
one golf course. There's two exceptional courses, Macrahanish and Macrahanish Dunes.
And they might be getting a third, I've heard.
I have also heard there might be, but yeah, we'll see on that one. We'll see. But going to that part of the world is probably how, you know, if you were traveling to Scotland to play golf in the 50s and, you know, before it was a common thing to do, that's what you're getting in 2024 at Macrahanish.
Yeah.
It's the same vibes. Nothing's really changed that much. I mean, they've got a pretty modern clubhouse. I think there might have been a fire. That's usually part of the course, isn't
it? Yeah. But I've never gone
there's
into
always a fire.
I've never gone to a snooker club and gone, God, it's a lovely brand new snooker club you've got here. And they've gone, yeah, it burned down just like all the other snooker clubs. Golf clubs.
How convenient.
Like, honestly, I don't know how anyone insures their golf clubs because, like, statistically, you have like a 1 in 5 chance of burning down that week. It's crazy. But Macrahanish is like you say.
It's just
we went last year. It felt like you're in untouched part of the world.
Exactly. It's basically untouched.
And best scenery in Scotland?
I would say if you were going to, yes, the drive.
The
Mull in Kintyre. I mean, I did it a couple of years ago in a camper van. And, you know, they have a right to roam in Scotland as well. So you can park up a camper van at the side of any road on any piece of land and camp there without permission for one night. It's completely fine. So we were doing that, pulling up on these, and they have little lay-bys designed for people doing this.
Yeah.
And quite often you're the only person there. And just these little alcoves, beaches, and you pull in, make a little fire, and all you can see is on the horizon, the outlines of the other islands in Scotland, like, you know, to the west, and the sun sets down, there's seals swimming into the bay, like popping their heads up. It's just serene. I'd say, you know, I've been very lucky. I've traveled a lot, and, you know, driving a camper van around that part of the world, we had good weather. Probably the best trip I've ever done.
Yeah, I would agree. I think last year when we did that shoot for FootJoy for the Harris Tweed, and we just had to go to Harris, was the long and short of it. But we badged on like Macrahanish, Carradale, Dan Haverty, and then we drove up and we Kirkcross, did Askanish, played Try. I mean, that whole stretch. And I think if you really want to push it
out. What was Askanish like?
It was good. It's a very remote part of the world, and I feel like it's kind of geared up a little bit for the traveling golfer. Not in a bad way, but it's breathtaking Duneland, and it's highly remote, and it's from 7 on, it's staggeringly good.
Mm.
I don't know how many people on South Uist are playing on a regular basis because it's an exceptionally small population. It's not a
course that Halcyon Golf Travel have put many people through.
Is that right?
No. No, it's
but it's doable. I think so much of that is the CalMac. I think CalMac ferries, like it's hard because you've got to provide surety and you've got to coach your clients through that journey of like you're going to play and this is where you're going to go. And those CalMac ferries, it's like roll of the dice whether or not it goes, whether it turns up, and it must be horrible being in that situation.
And they don't publish a timetable until, you know, like 2 months before the season starts.
And you get them on, they're 2 minutes late, they're in the wrong ferry port, and it's like all of a sudden everything. So I think there's a fine line. If you really want to push it out and travel, like, hell yes, go to Harris. Go and see the Macri. I've never been to the Macri, but I know it would be amazing. You know, like,
and Ardfin is another one. I mean, if you've got a little bit of budget, Ardfin is one you've got to go and try.
And they're open to visitors, from what I've heard.
They are open for visitors. I think to play there, you have to stay in the hotel.
Yeah,
which is off the charts, super luxe.
And if you want to get away from that sort of, like, if you want to feel like you're the only man out there playing golf, that stretch of remote golf.
The island of the Ardfin is on has a population of 300 people, and I'm pretty sure half of those people work at the hotel. for 10 guests that are there, that's the level. It's quite unique.
Closing this podcast with a bit of a question: where does golf travel industry go? Because I feel like there is such a buzz around golf in GB and I right now. And I've seen probably in the last 15 years, a lot of clubs go from, you know, I don't know, COVID just maybe put a couple of year hiatus in, which meant that the jump in green fee was like more noticeable. Mm. But now it feels like traveling golf is such a big industry over here.
Yeah.
Is it a flash in the pan? Is it here to stay? Can it go higher? Like, the demand that you see at the moment for people wanting to come and play these places.
Yeah, the demand is extremely high. And I think COVID had a big part to play in that. I think, you know, having that short period of time where you weren't allowed to travel internationally has kind of given people the inspiration that wouldn't usually make the journey to go, okay, well, now that we are allowed to leave the country, let's go and visit Scotland and England and Ireland. And the demand has been driving the prices up. I do think there's longevity in tourism over to the UK. I think the product is so good, The demand can't drop. It's just too good. But I think there is a ceiling to the prices, and I think we're reaching the ceiling now. It's the, you know, green fees at these top courses have been rising at a rate well above inflation for the last 5-6 years especially. But I think they're maxing out,
because the unique thing is they're not resorts, are they? They're members clubs.
Yeah, they're members
clubs. Finite capacity.
Yeah, they have finite capacity, and at the end of the day, the members have got to be able to play there. But in a lot of cases, the members aren't complaining, because it's the visitor revenue that's funding the members. You know, you can be a member of a top 20 course over here and not pay more than 1500 quid for membership because it's subsidized by visitor green fees, which is, you know, I think when I explain this to my American guests, you know, they are very envious of that, you know, because they're used to, you know, paying through their teeth to be a member of the country club.
It's a different model for golf, isn't it?
It's totally different. It's totally different. But what I do see, and I think this is where I'm trying to take Halcyon golf travel, is, you know, taking the less beaten track. And there are so many great courses to be played in the UK that where you don't have to pay 400 quid to play. Places like, you know, where we are today, Blackwell or Holinwell, where the Brabzon is this year. Obviously slightly biased, Holinwell's my home club, but as inland heathland golf courses go,
it's blockbuster.
It's blockbuster stuff. Yeah. Everybody that I've ever taken there has left with a smile on the face, and on the way in, their jaw has been on the floor. You know, driving down the drive,
and you've got, I think, a lot more breadth to golf in England. I think that's probably the only thing.
But if you can play these courses for less than 200 quid, and have an absolutely mega day out, and I think there's always going to be, you know, the product that is five star golf, you know, Old Course, Carnoustie to Kings Barnes, or in Ireland, Ballybunion, Lahinch, Royal County Down, Portrush. That's always going to be there. But I think the real growth is in the lesser known, off the beaten track golf courses. And, you know, if you're even slightly adventurous, then I would highly recommend, you know, trying to tie in a few of these hidden gems with the headline courses when you make the trip over.
Well, I've really enjoyed that, Jack.
Yeah.
If people wanted to learn a little bit more or wanted to talk to you, then get in touch with you on their website, right?
Yeah. I'm very easy to contact. So, yeah, just have a look on the website, or I'm sure, you know, you can probably post a link on there.
Link in the show notes below. We'll put his mobile number. Yeah. He is readily accepting WhatsApp messages congratulating him. It's all of them. Have you had a good day?
I've had an excellent day. I don't want to go home. Not going to lie.
I think you should stay over and celebrate long into the evening.
I think we should. If only there was a dormy house at Blackwell, I'd be true. Thatched in.
Jack, it's been a pleasure having you on the podcast.
Sam, and thank you so much for having me. You know, I've lost my podcast virginity now.
Really, and hole in one, putting brandy, Blackwell virginity.
Had a hole in one, had loads of random drinks. I want to do it again.
And you thought life had peaked at 18 when you went on a golfing deal to Durham. How life changed. Thank you so much. And until next time.
Cheers, Sam.
Watch this.